This is Cradle My Heart Radio with your host, Kim Cotola. Cradle My Heart Radio, preventing abortion and helping those it hurts.
This is where the healing begins. Oh, this is where the healing starts. When you come to where you're broken within, the light meets the dark. The light meets the dark.
And now, Kim Cotola and Cradle My Heart Radio.
Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Cradle My Heart Radio, a program that is really dedicated to preventing abortion and helping those that it hurts. And one of the main ways that we endeavor to prevent abortion is to expose the truth of what it is, because even the law that was established abortion as a legal right in the land here in the U.S. Is based on lies and flawed reasoning and flawed jurisprudence. And I know when we start talking about the law, some of us feel like that's going to be over my head. But today we have a guest who's going to help us understand why this is important that we understand the law and make it easy for you and me to grasp the deep issues here on what he really calls the abuse of discretion by the Supreme Court in making abortion legal. Our guest is Clark Forsythe, who is senior counsel at Americans United for Life. His 27 years of service to AUL includes founding and directing the ALU Project in Law and Bioethics, serving for 6 years as vice president and general counsel. He's overseen nationwide litigation and legislation strategy, served as president for 10 years, and he's argued cases before federal and state courts and has testified before Congress and state legislatures. And if you check into his work, Abuse of Discretion, you will see that this book has won plaudits from so many people, including many, many law professors from places like Northwestern University and Stanford University. In other words, I hope that nobody would dismiss this out of hand as being a pro-life propaganda or merely a pro-life slant on this issue. Clark, welcome to Cradle My Heart Radio.
Thank you, Kim, for having me.
Tell me, first of all, about the process of writing about the law in your book, Abuse of Discretion. You spent a lot of time researching what went into this legal decision.
Well, several years ago, I started the book with a lot of questions. I was wondering why the justices issued such a sweeping decision, why they thought they needed to solve the abortion issue in America back in the early 70s. And those questions eventually led me to look for their personal papers. And I was able to eventually find the personal papers of 8 of the 9 justices. There are 9 justices on the Supreme Court, or there were back in 1973 when the decision was decided. I've been able to look at all but one justice's papers, which have not yet been released to the public. And when I got into the papers, they're at the Yale University and the Library of Congress and other institutions around the country. When I got into the papers, I was just shocked at what I found, because they tell a very different history about the Roe versus Wade and the Doe versus Bolton decisions than the public's ever heard before.
One of the reviews that I read said that your conclusion is that this was, in the reviewer's words, a poorly reasoned rush to judgment based on a wealth of misinformation that has since been debunked. You think that that's a fair characterization of abuse of discretion?
It is.
And in other words, the conclusion that you drew.
Yes. Well, we all need to remember that there's a basic distinction between courts and legislatures in our democracy. Legislatures are supposed to create the law and create broad legal rules. Courts are supposed to decide individual cases. But in Roe versus Wade, the justices decided to, quote unquote, solve the abortion issue and take control of the abortion issue and legalize it broadly, which is exactly what legislatures are supposed to do, not courts. And the justices knew that they were legislating. And they did it without any record of facts, without evidence, expert witnesses, and they did it in a very haphazard and thus abused their discretion.
And so, as I understand it, there are three main problems or three main flawed premises under which they did that. First being that they thought the decision was good for women's health. They also thought that there was a need for abortion to address the problem of world population and overpopulation. And then also they thought that this was what the people wanted, that there was a popular outcry for abortion and that there was some sort of cultural consensus. So let's take these points point by point and talk about, or if there's another or more that you feel we need to discuss, but maybe to start with these three. Why was there this idea that abortion would be good generally for women's health as a public health policy decision?
Well, because there was no record, there was no trial in these cases, there was no record of facts, no expert witnesses. The justices were kind of swimming in a vacuum of facts and reasons, and they were very much influenced by their own personal histories, by their family histories, by their experiences, and by the media and what they were hearing in the media in the early 1970s. And they did assume these three things and did rest their decisions, at least in part, on these three assumptions: that abortion was good for women, that the public wanted it, so they were very much influenced in the writing of the Roe versus Wade and Doe versus Bolton decisions by contemporary culture and what they were hearing in the media and what they were absorbing politically.
And so there's this one of the things about women's health persists till today, and you'll see it all over pro-abortion rights websites and writings, that abortion is safer than childbirth. What did your research uncover about that belief?
Well, they had no evidence to support that, no reliable data back in the 60s or 70s. There was no trial of in the lower courts of facts that would substantiate the notion that abortion was safer than childbirth, and they eventually were just scrambling for some medical evidence that would support this notion, the notion that abortion is safer than childbirth really drove the decisions and the outcome in the two decisions and the details of their decision. But they eventually latched upon 1950s data from Eastern European countries, Soviet bloc countries, and the data was unreliable. It was not substantiated, but they were told by the activist lawyers who were trying to legalize abortion in the cases that abortion was safer than childbirth, and it's based upon basically a comparison of the published abortion mortality rate, meaning deaths of women from the abortion procedure, versus childbirth mortality rate, deaths of women during childbirth. There was no reliable evidence at the time to compare these two rates or to show that abortion was safer than childbirth. And now, fast forward 40 years to where we are today, there's still this kind of crude mechanical comparison of the published abortion mortality rate and the published childbirth mortality rate. But they're non-comparable because these are rates, so there are numerators over denominators, but what goes into the two rates are basically apples and oranges, completely different, and thus completely non-comparable. And yet abortion advocates for 40, 50 years have used a mechanical comparison of these two rates to claim that abortion is safer than childbirth. And that has been told to women seeking abortion for 40, 50 years as well. And it's simply untrue, and it's unreliable, and should not be part of the information that women get before they consider an abortion.
You know, and it's shocking to me that as we're in some states now debating whether, you know, whether viability should be the benchmark for when abortion should be restricted. 20 weeks, there's a story in the news of a 19-week-old baby that survived miscarriage. You know, what really is that line? And the irony of hospitals taking heroic measures to save premature children and some of those
yes.
same facilities aborting children at the same age. You know, so as we think about this and the ethical and moral implications that ought to be guiding the conversation, I'm stunned that so many people think that a woman could safely abort a child at 23 weeks and not have health implications because of the size of the baby. I mean, this idea that something that is now a right through all 9 months of pregnancy would remain safe through all 9 months of pregnancy, I think, is one of the most dangerous aspects of the law. Maybe you could comment on that.
You're absolutely right. It's inconceivable that the justices should have legalized abortion throughout pregnancy from conception to birth for virtually any reason whatsoever, and it was a radical decision. It was a sweeping decision. It has isolated the United States as one of only four nations of 195 around the globe, only four that allow abortion for any reason after fetal viability. I mean, we're ranked or isolated with North Korea, China, and Canada as the only four nations that allow abortion for any reason after fetal viability. And it was part of the legislating that the justices did back then. They started drafting this decision in 1971, 1972, and they knew that they were legislating, and they were drawing lines, and they first started thinking they were going to draw the line at 12 weeks and allow abortion within 12 weeks, and then they were going to allow the states to limit or prohibit abortion after 12 weeks. But they eventually, after some lobbying behind the scenes and jockeying among themselves, they eventually decided to stretch it from 12 weeks to what they thought was viability back then, 28 weeks of pregnancy. And they did it for the sheer pragmatic reason of enlarging access to abortion. But what you cited about the concerns for women's health, they virtually didn't take into consideration at all. They had no evidence in front of them, and they did not consider the risks for women. They decided to defer to providers as to how late to do abortions, and they largely did so on the beginning myth that abortion was safer than childbirth. So it's had terrible implications.
Yeah,
for,
and you know, I mean,
40-50 years.
Oh, it's worse than scandalous. It really is tragic that women are believing that, well, I'm told it's safer and it's my right. So if you want to impede that, you couldn't possibly have my safety in mind. That's one of the most insidious evil things about it, I think. Clark Forsyth is our guest. He is with the Americans United for Life organization, and he has spent 20 years researching the papers of the eight of the nine justices who voted in Roe v. Wade and Doe v. Bolton. And the result is his volume, Abuse of Discretion, that we're discussing today. And the book has been out for a couple of years now, and it is one widespread praise from professors of law at universities such as Harvard, Stanford Law, Northwestern University School of Law. In other words, the highest institutions of learning and protectors of the law have said that that you have got it right, Clark. And I think that's just an amazing accomplishment, given that there is still so much political baggage about this. So now we wade into the waters of the second premise for this decision, overpopulation. I think we're still seeing the ripples of that with the climate change debate. And this has become, again, sort of a sub-controversy, I think, of the abortion debate. Talk about the climate of the times when this ruling was made and what we know now about whether there is a danger of overpopulation and whether abortion should be an answer.
Well, there were different motivations influencing different justices at the time, but in the late 1960s, it's hard to recall this, but in the late 1960s, the so-called population crisis and population control was a raging national issue. In fact, when Richard Nixon was elected president in November of 68, about 7 months later, just 6 months into his term or so, he gave a national speech to Congress, broadcast across the country, about the population crisis and what needed to be done about it. And it was a driving national issue. I mean, it was almost as big as ISIS is today. And the justices were definitely influenced by it. Some of the justices felt that, well, we need to legalize abortion because that will help solve the population crisis. And the reality over the last 40 years has been almost the flip-flopped. We now are facing a situation in many countries where they're facing a population implosion rather than a population explosion. The population growth is below replacement levels, and populations are declining. That's, for example, in Russia, along with the talk about Vladimir Putin's designs over the past year or two, there's been recognition of the fact that Russia is facing population implosion, and that will sooner or later create a crisis for the older generations when there are too few younger workers to sustain their, you know, system of Social Security and entitlements and benefits for the older generations. And many other countries around the world are facing the same population implosion. So it was a passing, almost a fad, that influenced some of the justices to think, we need to legalize abortion because it will help solve the population crisis.
And the third issue that the justices thought they had public opinion on their side, they thought that they were granting people the wishes of, you know, the public, of the population. So if, even if that were true, why is that problematic? When I talk with organizations about my overcoming an abortion in my past, which was based on ignorance and swallowing the lies of the abortion industry, and also, you know, desperate personal circumstances as I saw it at the time, I tell them that, you know, this cannot be considered equal rights, because if a right was granted to women, it was granted at the expense of the rights of children and men. How in the world did they come to this conclusion that everyone wanted abortion? Were they simply completely overcome by a feminist influence, by the feminist lobbying effort? I mean, how did that happen, that they got that so wrong?
Well, they were definitely influenced by the sexual revolution of the 1960s and the cultural turmoil of the 1960s. But to go to your question, the justices shouldn't be influenced by public opinion or passing public opinion polls. They should not legislate and like legislators do. They should not be overturning rules with broad new sweeping rules that upend what the states and the people have created. But they knew they were legislating in the Roe versus Wade decision, and they were very much influenced by public opinion polling at the time, and they were absorbing this through politics. They were absorbing it through the feminist movement of the late 60s, 70s. Obviously not all feminists are pro-abortion, but there was a contingent of feminists who were pro-abortion in the late 1960s and 70s. The establishment institutions like the American Medical Association were endorsing legalization to some degree. National Organization was endorsing it. The New York Times was pushing it, as other leading newspapers were. And the justices thought that they were leading a cultural wave, that they were ahead of the cultural wave and public opinion wave that was moving toward legalizing abortion, and they simply got it wrong. I mean, some states in the late 60s and early 70s had legalized abortion to a small degree, but at the time of the Roe v. Wade decisions in January 1973, 30 states still, despite debate, legislative debate in those states, despite public debate, the 30 states still retained a prohibition on abortion except to save the life of the mother. And even in the 2 years before the Roe versus Wade decision in 71 and 72, no state had legalized abortion, and public opinion polling showed that the public is more divided than the justices assumed. So they acted as politicians, and they simply got it wrong. And we've been living with the political turmoil that shows the extent to which they got it wrong for the last 42 years.
Clark Forsyth, Senior Counsel at Americans United for Life, with 27 years of service to AUL, and he has graciously provided a copy of the book, which he wrote for the layman, for you and me, for people who are not legal scholars, to be able to unravel this complicated story and give us the backstory of how such a flawed law became the law of the land. You know, in the few minutes that we have remaining, I'd like to ask you if your book is very descriptive of the problem, if you have a description for how to work our way past this abuse of discretion, what you see on the horizon at any rate.
Well, there's really no silver bullet that's going to solve this. We have been pursuing a political and legislative and educational and medical solution for the last four decades against overwhelming odds and huge obstacles. Billion-dollar organizations like Planned Parenthood and so forth, but we have seen progress month by month, year by year, in the number of states that protect the unborn child as a human being, in the number of states that require that women get full information before they can have an abortion, and in other laws that reflect public opinion, supported by public opinion, that are putting more and more limits on abortion and abortion providers. We are really seeing these laws reflective of public opinion and where public opinion stands in 2015, that most Americans would like to see fewer and fewer abortions, and at the very least as early in pregnancy as possible, and that fundamentally conflicts with the sweeping decision that the court created, and that explains the political turmoil we've seen over the last 40 years.
And so when an abortion proponent will argue to you that you're just trying to limit women's rights by supporting statewide legislation that, for example, might put restrictions on clinics or have admitting privileges for doctors make as a requirement. How do we answer that? I mean, is the answer simply, yes, we are, because this is one way that we can, sort of restore the will of the people, if you will?
That's absolutely true, but the fundamental reason is that abortion's bad for both. It's bad for unborn children, and it's bad for women, and the limits that the states have been legislating on abortion and abortion providers and the abortion procedure are designed to protect women's health. Admitting privileges are really common sense limits that require abortion providers to have privileges that allow them to admit any patient that has a complication after an abortion at a local hospital. That's important for women's health. Ultrasound technology needs to be part of the informed consent process, so that a woman knows fully the nature, risks, and alternatives to abortion. And you know, there are a number of other limits that the states are legislating that I could touch on, but the basic foundation is that abortion's bad for women and children, and needs to be eliminated.
Clark, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for making a copy of Abuse of Discretion available for our listeners. We really appreciate you being with us today.
Thank you, Kim. It was great to be with you.
Clark D. Forsyth, Senior Counsel at Americans United for Life. His book, Abuse of Discretion, is available wherever books are sold. And if you would like to enter a drawing to receive a copy of it, just go to cradlemyheart.org and see all the details there about how to obtain a copy for yourself. Cradlemyheart.org also is where you will find the links to our social media, where you can stay up to date on our weekly guests, as well as articles and resources available for our mission, preventing abortion and helping those that it has hurt. Stay tuned for more of Cradle My Heart Radio. We'll return with this week's top news story on the cause of life and your phone calls at 800-811-3003.
This is Cradle My Heart Radio with your host, Kim Cotola. Cradle My Heart Radio, preventing abortion and helping those it hurts. Safe place to connect with others, finding God's love after abortion. This is Cradle My Heart Radio. Cradle My Heart with Kim Cotola. Join the conversation. Call toll-free 800-811-3003. 800-811-3003.
Thanks for listening tonight. Glad to have you with us here for the live half hour of Cradle My Heart Radio. Following our recorded interview this week with Clark Forsyth, the senior legal counsel for Americans United for Life. I would love to hear your reaction if you were with us for that part of tonight's broadcast. Were you aware of the many problems with the legislation on Roe versus Wade? And did it resonate with you that connecting the dots here between public opinion polls, which were manufactured, and allowing abortion through all 9 months of pregnancy, which was supposed to be the will of the people, but was not, has left us one of only four countries that allows abortion post-viability after 20 weeks. I mean, how does this strike you? Does it make you angry? Does it sadden you? Does it redouble your efforts for trying to limit abortion incrementally? Does it make you want to abolish abortion forever? I just would love to hear your reaction if you were able to join us for that part of the broadcast tonight. Our phones are open at 800-811-3003. And if you have a question or a comment, just by way of discussion, our guest, as I said, this was a recorded interview, so Clark Forsyth is not personally available to answer your questions, but we do have copies of his book. We have two copies of Abuse of Discretion for our first two callers with a question or comment at 800-811-3003. For years, I don't know if you would say I sidestepped all these questions about the legislation itself and Roe versus Wade. I thought to myself, I can't comment. I'm not a legal scholar. I can't comment. I haven't done my homework. Not sure that I could even understand it if I were to try to dive in and understand this. But boy, when you do, and when you take advantage of the scholarship and the research and the work of a person like Clark Forsyth, it's really troubling waters, to think how we got to this crossroads where abortion is allowed through all 9 months of pregnancy for any reason, as the federal law of the land. Yes, states are working to limit that, and every time a state is successful, the legal challenges begin. What do you think about this? 800-811-3003. And again, for our first two callers tonight to weigh in, copies of Abuse of Discretion, the resource from our earlier guest, Clark Forsyth. 800-811-3003. Also, we could talk about tonight, I finally saw the movie Wild. I don't know if you have seen this or if you read the book, that Cheryl Strayed wrote. It was an Oprah Book Club selection, I think in 2012, two, 3 years ago here. And the book showed up on my radar for that reason, and it seemed a pretty compelling tale. A young woman who's had a troubled life goes on a solo hike on the Pacific Crest Trail, which stretches all the way from Mexico to Canada along the West Coast, and some of the most challenging terrain that hikers can take on. And when I picked up the book and tried to take a stab at it, I found it very off-putting because of, if you will, the personality of the writer. There was so much vulgarity in the book, even in the early chapters, that seemed just unnecessary, that I just couldn't stay with it. And I was really interested in her story. Her roots in Minneapolis made me curious about, you know, some of the places that she'd been and some of the experiences that she would write about there. But I just had a rough time with it. Well, it's a big warning. If you have not seen the film with Reese Witherspoon nor read any interviews, she ends up in a lifestyle of extreme promiscuity due to being traumatized by the death of her mother, the death of her mother's companion animal, horse, and a great deal of trauma that she processes in her grief or forestalling grief through acting out sexually. And she becomes pregnant and ends up getting an abortion as part of the story. And I should have issued a spoiler alert there. But I was intrigued about how the movie portrayed that aspect of her story. Because her character in the story, in the movie that is, Reese Witherspoon plays the author, and it's based on true events, is forced to go and get a pregnancy test by her friend, who calls her out for her extreme depravity, really, self-destruction in the way that she's been acting out. And when she says, "I might be pregnant," she goes with her and stays with her in the public restroom while she uses the pregnancy test. And then, you know, they go out to the car, and you see the Cheryl Strayed character being, you know, extremely upset with herself, now angry with herself. "How did I let this happen? I cannot have this baby," she says. And, you know, "How did I become such a terrible person," using much worse language than that. And she's written about it in her book. She's written about it in extended articles in the Sun magazine and elsewhere. And basically, this is what she says. I was a terrible person for having done this. And, you know, I don't want to heap blame on her. The book has raised some controversy in circles among, including people who are hikers, who say that they don't really believe her story of hiking the trail, that many of her details don't add up. And I'm not qualified to speak to that. But I could not escape trying to, again, connect the dots of the trauma that this woman experienced in the midst of her season of disintegration. And it brought up to me the many stories that I've heard through the years when I was in our conference ministry with Ruth Graham and friends. We traveled internationally for 3 years, and I listened to many, many stories. I listened to stories for a short feature that we produced on healing and redemption after abortion called Life Redeemed. I heard so many stories from so many people about one-night stands and the devastation that that can wreak in the life of a woman. Sometimes she blacks out and does not even recall the encounter and now is pregnant. And if that description fits you, I think that it's really helpful to back up and take a look at the entire experience through the lens of grief and loss. This is not an excuse nor a rationalization, although there were many times in this watching this film portrayal of Cheryl Strayed's book Wild that I was infuriated with her skills at rationalizing her problems. she's a deeply troubled person in this movie who's had a very troubled life. She's a troubling person. She's got troubling coping, I should say. I don't want to label anybody a troubling person, but the grief that fueled and drove all of the behavior that was so outside of her best interest and the interests of everyone she was interacting with was centered in loss and grief. And I don't know if that holds a key for you tonight, to look in a different direction if you've been thinking about guilt and self-rejection after abortion. But it may. And so I hand you that. That if there is grief and loss at the center of something that motivated you to make that choice, perhaps now is the time to begin a season of kindness and restoration. There's a great passage of scripture in 1 Peter that talks about what God does for us in a season of suffering, and especially after a season of suffering. And, you know, when we talk about what happens after a season of suffering, I think that it helps me anyway to realize that our job in the season of suffering sometimes is simply to see it through. In 1 Peter 5:10 and 11, it says, "And the God of all grace, who called you to his eternal glory in Christ, after you have suffered a little while, will himself restore you and make you strong, firm, and steadfast. To him be the power forever and ever. Amen." Our job is to get through it with him, ascribing to him the power. Not to random sexual partners, not giving that power away, seeking that comfort, not to the drug use that she entered into and that some of us have in our past, not to any escapism as a way of giving up our power and making ourselves helpless in the face of the things we are overwhelmed by. If that scripture resonates with you, maybe you'd like to share a verse that got you through a season of suffering, that got you through a season of departure from who you knew God intended you to be. 800-811-3003 is our number. I'm Kim Cotola, and I'm so glad that you're listening tonight. We're here for you live. Our new format will include a recorded interview to begin each week's broadcast, and then a chance to interact live. And tonight, when you call, we have copies as our gift to you of Clark Forsythe's book, Abuse of Discretion. It's his extremely well-researched analysis of how Roe versus Wade was an overreach by the Supreme Court when they entered into making law rather than, as they should have, interpreting the law. Join us, 800-811-3003 here at Cradle My Heart Radio. It's time for a short break, and then we'll be back.
A safe place to connect with others. Finding God's love after abortion. Cradle My Heart Radio with Kim Cotola. Call toll free at 800-811-3003. Seeking to help others find God's love after abortion. Cradle My Heart Radio with Kim Cotola. Call toll free at 800-811-3003.
Thanks so much for being with us. This is the live portion of our broadcast tonight, and we'd love to hear your voice at 800-811-3003. You do not have to give your name when you call in, and if you want to share your story, I would just love to give you the chance to do that. And you know, it's healing to share our stories, as much or as little as you're comfortable sharing. 800-811-3003. When you join our conversation tonight, we will have a copy of Abuse of Discretion by our guest Clark Forsythe, and we'll have the podcast posted on that this week if you didn't get a chance to listen to the recorded interview that we used to start the broadcast tonight. He was writing after 20 years of research into the papers of the eight of the nine Supreme Court justices who ruled on Roe versus Wade. And the brief recap tells us that they had no lower court rulings. They had no evidence. They had no witnesses subject to cross-examination. Attorneys who presented the case had only nine documents, one of which was a letter to the editor. There was no peer-reviewed research supporting claims that abortion, for example, is safer than childbirth. And yet it became the law of the land. And he said this is an abuse of discretion, that the justices, yes, have discretion to rule on the law, but not to make the law. And his prescription for the remedy to this is what we're seeing state by state. Lawmakers seeking to limit this or abolish abortion in their states. Love to hear what your thoughts are about that. 800-811-3003. 800-811-3003. One of the things that I have been, if you want to talk about the Cheryl Strayed example of abortion as a breakdown after an extreme trauma and grief event in one's life, we can talk about that too. Maybe not necessarily your own trauma and grief, but maybe you have counseled a friend through an experience like that. Maybe you have examples from other stories or even literary characters that bring forward this connection between a huge loss and then the decision to abort a pregnancy. 800-811-3003. I have an undergraduate degree in ministry, but I'm not a professional counselor. So my interest in discussing that part of it is not to offer you psychotherapy, but to help you see that so often we're blind to the things that do drive us. We're blind to what our true motivations might be. And I will say this, I have spoken with so many professional counselors through the years in my experiences as a journalist and as a broadcaster, that I have learned so many of them do make this connection, whether it's Dr. Teresa Burke, the founder of Rachel's Vineyard, or Dr. Philip Ney, working through his Hope Alive program. And what Dr. Ney says is that people who have been subject to neglect, women who've been subject to neglect, have in very important ways been depersonalized, which makes it much easier to depersonalize the child growing inside you and make the abortion decision. I don't know if that resonates for you or not, but somehow hearing that brought me comfort. Abortion so alienates us from ourselves, I think, on many deep psychological levels and deep spiritual levels, where we say it was a decision made in desperation. It was a decision made in panic, in fear. And in the aftermath, we say, well, how could I? And if you can follow the thread of some of those hidden motivations that are common to us but not revealed easily, I think there's great healing in that. And, of course, our ultimate hope for healing lies in the redemption already attained for us by Christ and receiving it, in humbling ourselves to receive His mercy. And if that's offensive to you because you have not experienced abortion, the idea that God can forgive it, I just return to the statement that someone made to me years ago when I was engaged in prison ministry, that if it was deserved, it wouldn't be mercy. If we should have been forgiven, it's not mercy. 800-811-3003. But God's mercy is fresh and new every morning. 800-811-3003. Would love to hear your thoughts. Abuse of discretion is our gift for those who call in tonight. And if you want to leave a comment on our website, simply go to cradlemyheart.org and use the comment field on the contact page or the about page. And that's a way you can pose a question or weigh in when we note who our guests are going to be for the upcoming broadcasts. And would love to hear from you either way. I know that there are people, I hear from people on email that are concerned that their voice would be on the air let alone their name. And so I understand the need for privacy, but I would still love to hear from you. So send us an email. You can tweet to me or private message me on Twitter, at Kim Catola. We're, of course, we're on Facebook at facebook.com/CradleMyHeart. And those are linked at CradleMyHeart.org if you didn't have a chance to write them down. There's a really encouraging piece at Live Action News. I don't know if you visit that website regularly. It's the website of Lila Rose, who made her mark and is still continuing her work to go undercover into abortion facilities and to record what happens there in patient interactions. She sends in members of her team posing as patients, but the videotaped stories of what is going on have been shocking and have helped to, I think, stem the tide. She's exposed facilities helping a pimp procure an abortion for an underage girl who was trapped in sex slavery. She's exposed an abortion facility guaranteeing that a donor's funding would go to kill black babies because he felt that that was the appropriate thing to do. Live Action is really well-established pro-life organization, and they do a great job of covering the news. They've got a post this week that, again, I found very encouraging about six people who are proving that common reasons for abortion are wrong. And so they just compiled some great stories, many of which I've seen on my Facebook feed recently. But if you haven't, this is a great article. We'll get it linked on our Facebook page tonight, too. The first one that they mention is one of the people proving common reasons for abortion are wrong, Noah David Smith. According to Dr. Brian Scottko, it says on Live Action News, who's a pediatric geneticist, over 90% of babies diagnosed with Down syndrome are aborted. We've reported on that. We've had guests on talking about that. But Live Action News this week says, while some babies are undoubtedly aborted based on a flawed prenatal testing result or inaccurate medical counseling after diagnosis, children like Noah Smith are proving that regardless of the circumstances, Down syndrome is not an acceptable reason to end a child's life. Because Noah is a boy whose father has written, changed their lives for the better. Down syndrome is not a death sentence unless parents choose to make it so. Then those who abort for doctors' predictions, they present the story of Easton Orris. Doctors told Easton's mom he was missing organs and would probably die in utero, so abortion was recommended. But this baby's mom chose life, and today he's nearly 2 years old, and Easton is thriving. And she says his personality is so funny. She said she's never met a funnier baby. He's sweet as well. She chose life despite doctors' predictions. And you and I probably have both heard stories, maybe too many to recount, about wrong prenatal diagnoses, right? Live Action News, some very encouraging stories there. Let's go to the phones. Diane, we only have a somewhat short time remaining for you to share your story, but as much as you can, if you can give us a telescoped version, we'd love to hear what you have to say in joining us tonight. Hi, Diane. Welcome to Cradle My Heart Radio.
Hi. I just want to thank you for all you do. This is just such a wonderful program to listen to. I had an abortion over 30 years ago, and to this day, I have a hard time forgiving myself. It's something that, I was told it was safer than childbirth, just like what you were talking about. I had three previous children, but because my ex-husband at the time didn't want any more children, I was forced to have an abortion. And consequently, I had it at a hospital locally and got a severe infection, ended up back in the hospital, and could never have any more children after that. So for them to say it's safer than childbirth, I can tell you that, like I said, I could never have children after my abortion. And so it's just wonderful to hear that you've got a program like this on the air. I have a hard time. My children are all grown up now. Like I said, I'm 60 years old almost, and I've never told them, and I have a really hard time with that because I'm afraid that they'll never forgive me if I would ever tell them.
Well, Diane, again, because our time is so short, I want you to hold on after the program ends so you and I can talk just a little bit more, if that's okay. Will you do that for me? Okay, Diane, you hold on, and you and I are going to talk off the air because there's so much that I want to say. But for anyone listening who has faced such hard consequences of not being able to conceive after abortion and lingering guilt, it's so easy to get our emotional wires crossed. This is something I wrote about at length in Cradle My Heart, my book, and we'll talk about it more next week. Know, though, God is not punishing you. He is for you. He loves you, and He is longing for you to receive the mercy that He came to provide. Please go to cradlemyheart.org to learn more, and be in touch, and be encouraged. Jesus loves you, and so do we. We'll be back next week. We're here. Hope you will be too.